Okay. You ready?
Yeah, let's do this.
Disruptive Peacemakers.
You are listening to the Disruptive Peacemakers podcast, a podcast that asks the question, what is peace? What is a peacemaker? And how can peacemaking be disruptive? One that interrupts injustice, that disarms evil, and takes on the arduous and ongoing pursuit of racial reconciliation and racial justice.
Hey, everyone. Welcome back to the Disruptive Peacemakers podcast. This is John Williams, and I am with whom?
You're with me, John, your trusty sidekick. It's Aaron. I'm here with you here today.
Yes. So glad you're here, Aaron. How are you feeling today?
I'm feeling good. Yes. I'm really excited about our next guest because she's a powerhouse.
Yes.
She's a powerhouse. Yeah.
For sure. Yeah. I'm super excited about it as well. I'm also glad that it's the end of the week. And so that just means I get to do all of my pet projects like this podcast.
Yes.
So Aaron, why don't you introduce our guest today?
Our guest is Dr. Joyce Del Rosario. She is currently an assistant professor on the practice of ministry at Pacific School of Religion. Her doctoral research is focused on Mary, Mother of Jesus, from a Protestant perspective, and how her marginalization resonates with other marginalized groups of women, like teen moms. Her current research is with an affectionately named group of Filipino-American religious scholars called the Theo Adobo Collective. We're going to have to ask her about that one. Theo Yes. Adobo has just been awarded a 3-year collaborative research grant from the Louisville Institute to explore emerging Filipino-American theology in the age of COVID-19. Welcome, Dr. Joyce.
Good to be here. Thank you.
Yes. Hi. Hi.
So, Dr. Joyce, should we call you Dr. Joyce? Should we call you Joyce?
For here, you can call me Joyce. In class, I'm Dr. Del Rosario.
Oh, I love it.
I give a whole spiel at the beginning. It took my village to get me to where I'm at. And so every time they call me Dr. Del Rosario, it honors the whole village that got me to the place where I can speak to the students. So.
That's amazing.
So it's a celebration every time my students call me doctor.
I love it. Yes. I love it. So we're just going to just start at the top. Aaron gave a little bit of your bio, but we always like to ask our guests to kind of give their own self bio. And so why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself in terms of what you want our listeners to know about you?
Right. The way we describe ourselves changes at the moment. So this moment, this is how I'll describe myself. Born in LA, grew up in Seattle, and grew up in a Filipino-American United Methodist Church, was trained in a Presbyterian seminary somewhere in ministry, became charismatic, was evangelical by PhD trade and ministry. And then now I'm more of this progressive end of the spectrum at Pacific School of Religion. And so, I don't know. I love Jesus. I love people. That's the spectrum I'm on. So.
That's so good. So Joyce, we'll start with the thing that stuck out most to me, which is your doctoral research, which is focused on Mother the Mary of Jesus from a Protestant perspective. How did you even come up with that research query or question?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. So I spent 20 years, over 20 years in youth ministry, mostly with immigrant and low income communities. The last 4.5 years or so, I was working at a home for teen moms in East Palo Alto, California. And so, when I started the PhD program, I had just finished that kind of part of my life. And so teen moms are certainly on my mind and thoughts. And in class, we were going through the Vatican II documents because, you know, that's what you do in a seminary doctoral class or whatever. So we were going through the documents. We get to the Mariology part and, you know, all of us are Protestant in the room and no one knew what to do with Mary.
Wow.
So my mostly male class was like, well, okay, moving on. They were ready to go. And I was like, no, wait, like this is the one time we're talking about women. Let's hang out here for a little bit.
Yeah.
And I remembered my youth ministry professor at Princeton, Kenda Creasy Dean. She did her doctoral research on Mary as a teen mom, but likened youth pastors as the midwives.
Okay.
So, you know, the ministry of pointing to Christ, of delivering, kind of bearing with the moms of their faith. Mm-hmm. And so that kind of got me in it. And I thought, well, sociologically and ministry praxis wise, I understood teen moms. It'd be really cool to kind of delve into this Mary thing. And I'm Filipino, but I grew up Protestant, so I actually didn't know anything about Mary, like a lot of Protestants.
Yeah.
So I sought out to look for a liberative Protestant Mariology, which is basically a Mary that speaks to us Protestants, but from her marginalized standpoint. So mm-hmm. essentially, I was trying to look for the non-white Mary.
Wow.
And what does that mean for us?
Right. Yeah. I think what's fascinating about your research is, as I think through my own faith journey, out of all the years that I've been a Christian, I think I may have heard 2 or 3 sermons total. And I'm old. I've been in the faith for a long time.
And in December, You always heard it in December?
Right. Always in December. Yep. And so my Catholic brothers and sisters, though, I know that she's revered, but I'm not of the Catholic faith. And so that's what really intrigued me when I started researching you. So what's like the main point that you took away from your research with Mary? And I love the fact that you center her from a marginalized perspective, because I think certain theologies, they don't do that. One, she's ignored. And if she's talked about again, it's only we roll her out during Christmas time.
Mm-hmm, exactly. Yeah, I talk about it as we only unpack her out of the box, Christmas decoration box, every Advent, and then we put her right back, and then we never talk about her until December rolls around again.
Yeah.
I have a lot of aha moments out of this dissertation, but at least as far as Mary's concerned, and this is going to sound really—I don't know how it's going to sound. I'm just going to say it: the Catholics aren't wrong about Mary.
Right.
She's amazing. She is amazing. But because of the history, because of all sorts of patriarchal and white systemic things, we've been trained as Protestants to eschew her because we don't want to worship her, mm-hmm. as if that's the only way you can look at Mary, is either to worship her or just ignore her.
Right.
And so, the more I dug in and I thought, wow, she's amazing. And we haven't paid enough attention to her.
Wow.
So I sat with her in the margins. Mm. I saw a whole different Mary. And then suddenly she was a Mary that made sense to me and my body and my skin. And it made sense to a lot of teen moms that I know and a lot of friends that I know. And so suddenly she wasn't just important. She was vital to my understanding of Christianity, really.
Yeah, no, that's amazing. That's amazing. There's so many different directions that we can go about.
Yeah. And before we move into any of those, let's just go back and this Theo Adobo Collective. Can you talk about that a little bit?
So I was at an Association of American Religions conference. Mm-hmm. We're in a room of Asian American scholars, religious scholars. And I think there's 5 of us in the room that were Filipino American. And this doesn't happen. Like, this is like when the planets align together and suddenly it's like the Star of Bethlehem kind of a thing. And so we were like, oh my gosh, we need to take a picture. So we took a picture together. We didn't know each other. And when we took the picture and I saw it, I realized there's something in this. There's something very sacred about us finally finding each other. Mm-hmm. Filipinos have, for a whole number of reasons, have been isolated from one another. There's very few of us, and at least at this niche part of academia, which is Protestant theology or even Catholic theology, there's a niche set of us as well. And so for us to find each other was such a joy, because we're often, a lot of us are the only ones wherever mm-hmm. we're at. Wherever we're at. So we started to get together. We started talking, and we started talking about research that we were doing, and ended up applying for a 3-year grant with Louisville Institute. And they are giving us free rein to research emerging Filipino-American theology in the age of COVID-19. And so we're looking at how has it impacted our people? Mm-hmm. How does that impact there's a lot of Filipino American nurses and a lot of us in healthcare. A lot of us are frontline workers, but that has something to do with your faith. That has got to impact your spirituality, your family life, your economics. And so we want to know what that is. Like, how does that affect your way of seeing God? How does that affect the way that you are in your community? And so that's the kind of things that we're embarking on. We want to see, you know, how the churches are responding, how the Filipino American churches are responding to the pandemic, and even maybe even some of the political things like the insurrection. You know, did we say anything after that? And so we just want to kind of know what's out there, and we want to find each other again. That's really the main goal of the research, is we want to find each other and talk about spirituality. Sociology and psychology with Filipino Americans have done, there's some really great academics out there that have done really great work for us. Many times it's void of our religiosity, and Filipinos are at least 90%, you know, Christian, both Catholic and Protestant, mostly Catholic, Roman Catholic. And so to, you know, have these fields not actually talk about our spirituality really leaves out a big part of our identity. And so the Theodobo Collective, I think we realize it's on us to define, not define that, but to articulate who we are and articulate some of the things that, that we care about and we see and we value.
Yeah, I agree with you about a lot of the research, the scholarly work. I've been really digging into E.J.R. David's work on internalized depression. That's kind of one of my areas of interest that I'm trying to write about and think about. Is, and what I found fascinating in his work is he's Filipino, and so he really lays this out so nicely. And so your question about...
So grateful for his work.
Yeah. So your question about, did Filipinos say anything after the insurrection, or just those, he talks a little bit about that. And I'd love to hear your perspective on kind of speaking out. There's this whole thing going on right now with social media, but more importantly, over and above social media, is the all of the anti-Asian violence and rhetoric that's going on. And would love to get your perspective on that.
So March of last year, I was walking around my neighborhood in Berkeley, California, and a Black man in a truck drove by and yelled something at me. I don't know what it was. I had my headphones on, but he was angry. And then later on, I was talking to another Filipino friend, and she was like, yeah, I was at the farmer's market. And this, and he was also this Black man yelling at her, and then he spit on her.
Oh, Lord.
As I started asking about the stories, it wasn't just Black folks, of course, it was Black and brown and white, and more and more and more the stories started coming out. And I'm like, these are just my small circle of friends. It's not even, I didn't even get to the statistics at that point. And so we were finding it was pretty normal. I think when it hit me the most was a few months ago, I was on a call with a denomination and their Asian American caucus. Denomination, and an 82-year-old man said, you know, I've lived in my neighborhood for 30 years, and this is the first time I'm scared to walk out of my door. And then to read the violence against the elderly folks in Chinatown in Oakland, in San Leandro, and, you know, I thought about him, and I thought, they're scared to walk outside their doors. Right. They can't get groceries. They can't, you know, do whatever it is that they normally need to do, go to their doctor's appointments without fearing for their lives. And, you know, certainly I have, you know, Black friends who know that all too well. And so the divide or the sort of the conflict between the Asian and Black community is heartbreaking. Because at the end of the day, it's not us against the other. It's really white supremacy that built all of that. There's a history around it. There's a reason we have conflict and tension. There's a reason the riots happened in LA. It's because, I mean, the systems work the way they were supposed to work. And it's heartbreaking. And so, so I have a lot of personal sadness. And then professionally, I'm trying to do what I can. But even that, I realize it's so big. It's so big. So whatever awareness I can bring to point out, you know, our issue is not with each other. Our issue, Asians are not the virus. And Black people are not the villains. Our issue is not with each other. It's within the white supremacy system that has pit us against one another to believe that. Because at the end of the day, white supremacy wins. Yeah. Either way, we're both oppressed. Either way, we're both dying.
Yeah.
Certainly, you know, one with a higher rate and longer history of violence as well, but it doesn't mean that we're not dying either. So I don't know. It's what does justice look like in that face?
Right.
Well, we have to look at where the issues really lie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, you are not the first Asian that has spoken to me about this kind of thing that's happening between Blacks and Asians. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the Asians that I've spoken to about it, they're like, why is it that they're doing that to us? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that's the thing, right? So how do we, it's a question that's always been on my mind. Like, why is it that we cannot just see each other as alliances? Why is it that we can't just see each other as the ones that if we just like lock arms together, that we can fight this thing? But as long as we're all divided into our groups, right? Mm-hmm. The Asian group, the Black group, the Latinx group, mm-hmm. then this white supremacy thing, it will continue.
Yeah.
It will continue. And the thing also that's crazy is that you're talking about these incidents that happen in Northern California, mm-hmm. like one of the most liberal areas right. yep. around.
Yep.
And my sister lives up there. She had stories too of like people just like blocking her path,
yep.
not letting her pass because she's Asian. She tried to turn away from them and the people just followed her.
So Kathy Park Hong in her book, Minor Feelings, clarified this the most for me. And it really struck me. We were always set up to be pit against each other.
Right.
I'm going to get my dates wrong. So I'm not even going to try and pull it up. So just whatever.
Okay.
I get my dates wrong all the time. I don't know birthdays. Okay. So Civil Rights Act passed in
65. Okay. So 65. Civil Rights Act. Yeah. 60. Yeah. 60. We'll stay with 65.
The Immigration Act was lifted in, I think, 65 as well, or 66.
I think it was right after. It was immediately after, yes.
Immediately after. So Kathy Park Hong's point was the U.S. brought or allowed for more immigration from Asian American countries specifically, mm-hmm. professionals specifically.
Right.
So they bring in doctors who were already doctors, put them up on a pedestal and said, look at these Asians. They're model minorities. Mm-hmm. And look at them. Why can't you be like them? People who already came in as professionals, they didn't build themselves up from their bootstraps. They didn't, they were already professionals at that time. And then automatically the narrative was to pit us up against the Black community.
Right.
It was no win from the beginning.
Right.
And then we move into the neighborhoods, the same neighborhoods. And so we're competing for the same very few resources. And then. Mm-hmm. Then you've got the language barriers as well. And so, of course, there's going to be suspicion. Of course, there's. And then the model minority myth is so damaging, because what it's done is both Asians and white people, I mean, everyone really, bought into this myth that Asian Americans are basically white. That is not right. And Asian Americans believe this. Our internalized oppression makes us believe that the more white we are, the more white we can become, which, for the life of me, I've tried all my life to be a tall white man and I haven't accomplished it yet. But I've tried really, really hard. But that's the myth. It makes you keep trying to become that tall white man that we can never become. But then it also makes other people believe, oh, she must be the tall white man, because look, she's succeeding. She's got the education. She's got the right. job. She has things that I don't have. And so now we enter into this narrative that really was never meant for any of our thriving at all. So we all lose in that.
Yeah, it's fascinating. As those of us who really look at history understand that it's the same playbook that's been used from the inception of this country. If you go all the way back to Bacon's Rebellion, which was a rebellion with enslaved Africans, or actually indentured Africans and indentured Europeans, who were upset about what was going on with the elite class. And so they had this rebellion, and the response by the elite class was, we will give more advantages, not many, but we'll give more advantages to the poor white class over and above the Black class. And so that lower, that poor white class could always say that I might be a lot of bad things, but at least I'm not Black. And then you fast forward to the time that W.E.B. Du Bois was alive, and he started writing about the wages of whiteness and the souls of black folks. And he started writing about this same thing happening in terms of this divide and conquer, where the wages of whiteness is you have your white skin privilege. You might be dirt poor, but you at least you have that so that you have someone to look down on. And so then we fast forward to the 60s. What was going on historically? What was going on is just as you said, Joyce, is that the civil rights movement was in high pitch and we were actually getting laws passed. And in response to that, the country said, Asians will come in, we'll put them as model minorities so that we can continue to criticize and critique black folk and Mexicans at that time. And so we still have that lower class. And throughout all this conversation, we still are erasing one whole other group of people, which are indigenous folks. So it's really fascinating. So for me, as I'm looking at what's going on, and you know, the rhetoric is high and, you know, the fear is real. The fear is definitely real. But if we would just pause and say, just like you said, okay, what's driving this? It's not black folks. It's not Asian folks. What's driving this is the way that our system is set up racially with white supremacy and not the kind of KKK white supremacy. We're not talking about that. We're talking about systems that advantage white folks over and above everyone else.
And we, and you know, if we're talking about class, then we have to talk about the economics of it.
Exactly. Right?
And that's how all of that happens. And when we realize at the end of the day, the reason, the driving force for white supremacy is capitalism, truly.
Yeah.
I mean, and I know there's a lot of banter and, you know, around that. I'm not an economist by any means. But, you know, just from even an armchair perspective, I'm like, low income. Okay, race, here's a little bit of a nuance. But by and large, there's a big income gap and there's big disparities between the groups. So, you know, and that's why I ended up focusing that even in my Mariology dissertation was class. Because, you know, without delving into the economics of capitalism, it still plays such a heavy part on our, we just bless it, right? That's the one that kills me is, you know, in the 90s, I remember there's this like huge, like, oh no, prosperity gospel. But then I went to Silicon Valley and I'm like, it's all prosperity gospel in Silicon Valley. I don't know what church thinks they're not prosperity gospel because you're XYZ denomination. Like if you're in Silicon Valley, you already believe it.
Right.
It's just part of the system.
Right. For sure.
It's not a critique on people's beliefs.
Yeah.
It's just the actual systems in place.
Yeah. A moment ago, you asked, what is...
I'm treading in waters I shouldn't be treading in.
I know. It's okay. you asked a moment ago, what does justice look like in this issue and in this situation? Can you unpack that a little bit? How are you seeing justice looking?
Justice for me is when I can be in my body in public and exhale. As a brown-skinned Filipina woman, that's it. I could do that for any one of my other, you know, folks who might consider themselves marginalized for different reasons. But as long as we can be with one another and exhale and not fear ourselves, there's a sense of justice that we would have arrived at that point. But that's not the case right now.
You know, when you talk about that earlier, you also said that when you were talking about the Theo Adobo Collective, that you realized there were five Filipinos in the same room together. And so you you came together, right? And you felt like the stars were aligning. Do you feel that prior to that moment, were there ever instances where when you saw another Filipino or another Asian, you stayed away and you tried to be not a part of them? Because me, as a Asian Japanese person, I know there was a good stretch of my life where it seemed that if I saw another Japanese American and another Japanese American saw me and we didn't know each other, we would act like we didn't see each other.
Yeah. That's part of our internalized depression, right?
Yeah, totally. Right. And then you just cannot be yourself because now that I'm old and I'm just so grumpy all the time, I'm like, you know what? I love when I meet a person that's Japanese.
Yeah.
And I full on am like, hey, I'm Japanese. Are you Japanese? I'm Japanese. And I love that. And they think I'm super weird, but I don't care. But it's that feeling of just being able to accept who I am and to just to breathe through that. Right. Yeah. Yeah. No, I get it.
You can just exhale. I mean, it's, yeah. I mean, in high school and part of college, I certainly felt like that. I didn't want to identify with other Filipinos because usually they try to set me up with the one other Filipino guy.
Exactly.
I'm like, I'm not interested in him just because I really like the blonde boy. That never worked out for me. I had a lot of internalized oppression. Yeah, but then, you know, now, exactly, growing up, it's like, as soon as I see a Filipino, it's like, oh, hey. You know, I try to be cool on the outside, but I'm not, because inside I'm like, who? I wonder where, you know, I wonder if they'll be my friend. Anyway.
No, that's really good. That's really good.
Yeah, because there is a commonality, right? Mm-hmm. There is a commonality when you are sitting in a group with other Asians and you can just understand the stories that they're coming in with. Mm-hmm. And especially I would imagine that if you're sitting in a group of Filipinos, Filipinas, that there's things you just don't have to explain. You just know, right?
Yep. Yeah. I mean, and not even having to say things, right? Just knowing you're in the room with each other is like, oh, you know, half the time, you know, some of us know Tagalog, some of us don't, or some of us speak a completely different language. Actually, you know, a lot of us do. So we don't even have those connecting points of language or even that. But just knowing that you're there is like, okay, it's cool. We embody the same space and we know what it's like to be that Filipino in the room. And so to know that together makes a difference.
Yeah, that's good. So I want to stay kind of in this area. How do we show solidarity for each other? Because we talked about the conflict. What are ways that we can actually show solidarity? Like that, what Chinika Walker Barnes calls that walking alongside of or walking along this. Yeah. How do we do that?
You know, Dr. Walker Barnes embodies it as well. She's right. The last time I saw her actually at a conference, I mean, she just gave me this huge hug and I haven't seen her in a while. And I think that's it, right? It's knowing each other. It's seeing each other, knowing people's stories. I just wrote a little blog post on like kind of how to support Asians in this time right now or Asian Americans in this time. And, you know, a couple of the things was like, know our stories. Like, right. I can tell you, I know some Black history, probably not as much as I really need to. Mm-hmm. I definitely know white history, but I can guarantee you none of y'all know Filipino history or very little of Asian American history, you know? Right. And so know our histories. And, you know, PBS had this really great series on Asian American history that was just really well done.
Very well done.
Inheritance Magazine has been around for a while and they've been telling stories of Christian identity and faith together. And the issues and Reclaim magazine from the Asian American Christian Collaborative just started in this past year. And those are all stories that we share of who we are and our experiences. And so get to know our stories and us as well as, you know, I mean, it's basic humanity.
Right. It's basic dignity.
I don't know what it's like to be a teen mom, but man, being friends and walking in life with so many of them at this point, I understand a bit more of where they're coming from. I empathize a bit differently. I look at them very, you know, I'm really humbled in so many ways because I know the day-to-day things that they go through.
Right.
And what they offer and the beauty that they, you know, that they bring to the world and to their families.
That's great. One of the things that we do, that I do for my job at the Center for Racial Reconciliation in 2019, we went on our inaugural Asian American Civil Rights Tour. Most people were very familiar with the, you know, doing a Southern Civil Rights Tour to look at the history of African Americans and race and slavery and all of that. But for me, it was really important to help to create that space where we spent 6 days just focused on the different Asian ethnicities. And Aaron was on that trip with us and it was just amazing. It was really, as an African-American man, learning the different things that I learned, learning the similarities, learning the differences, and being able to, I think, a little bit better, being able to step in to understand that journey and have empathy, compassion, and do exactly what you said, which is just show basic humanity. So,
Yeah. And, you know, as the person that went on that trip, I think the Asian that went on that trip, it just felt so, it was that justice feeling we just talked about, right? Mm-hmm. To have John, a Black man, say, hey, nobody talk. Let's just give space for the Asians to come to the forefront and to process how they're feeling about this. Mm-hmm. Because there are a few occasions where we did that after we saw things that were very difficult, just silencing everybody else and asking the Asians to speak. And, you know, I've always been the type that just steps back as soon as they say, oh, okay, who would like to talk? I would step back. And I think that's an Asian thing that we do not talk. We just listen. We're quiet. Yeah. So I felt justice, John. I felt that ability to breathe and to feel like I'm seen, as opposed to just that, here it is, Dr. Joyce, the wedge between different groups, right? And what I'm saying is that Dr. Joyce has what do you call? Is it a webinar?
I'm calling it a podcast. It doesn't roll off the tongue, but that's. I didn't want to do a podcast, particularly for Asian Americans, because I wanted to show the array of different Asian Americans and what we look like. So I wanted to force everyone to deal with my brown skin every time when we say Asian. And so that's why I did the video cast, not because.
I love it. I love it. But can you explain why you titled it The Wedge?
Yeah. It came from an article. Well, the idea, but specifically an article in Inheritance Magazine by Kenji Kurumitsu. Where he talked about the model minority, the myth of the model minority. And he talked about Asian Americans being used as a wedge between the Black-white binary. And so that's really what it was. And my answer, after Charlottesville, I doubled down and I wrote my first article on my attempt at post-colonial Filipino-American theology. After George Floyd, I did the wedge as a response because I can't necessarily speak into the Black-white binary, but I can double down on who I am. And so I decided, you know, Asian Americans were being seen as the Kung Flu, you know, the China virus, we're the coronavirus villains, you know. And at the same time, we're also not seen when we do show up for justice, when we do show up as allies. I just had a lot of friends, particularly in CCDA, Christian Community Development Association, who are Asian Americans, and they all shared, we're not seen in our communities, even though we're showing up every day. And so the wedge was a way for me to say, hey, Asian Americans, we're out here, and we're out here, and you may not even see us as Asian Americans, because we all, there's a wide variety. It's a very wide, wide term for us. So I just started interviewing folks around the country who were specifically in season one in solidarity with Black Lives Matter as Asian American practitioners, pastors, and academics. And so I just wanted my Black friends to say, hey, we're here and we're here for you and we want to center you, but also we're here, see us. And so that was my kind of way of responding. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're most always we're invisible. We're completely invisible. And I hate it. And, you know, you're right about that, because once John and I were talking and I didn't want to be Asian when I was young, didn't want to be Asian. I wanted to be either white or Black because they were visible.
Yep.
Yeah. No, that's, I love your video cast. I'll give it the correct term, The Wedge, and the reason behind it. I think that's great. In similar fashion for us this first season, every speaker, every guest is a woman of color, and it's based off of Dr. Walker Barnes's book and just kind of her analysis of reconciliation and justice. And so, yeah, I just love it. I'm wondering, So in your work with, in women's theology, women's theory, how has that shaped your role as a peacemaker, as someone who stands for justice?
Yeah, I'll do a quick connection. So in my work with Mary and teen moms, a lot of my teen moms were Latina and African-American. As I was kind of surveying, I decided, particularly because I wanted to focus on Protestant point of view, to not go with Mujerista theology. I just had to narrow down my scope. And so I started doing a lot more work in womanist theology and trying to find what they had to say about Mary, which was actually very little, but some, you know, did. And womanist theology, you know, particularly, you know, amazing women like Shaniqua Walker Barnes and Renita Weems and Dolores Williams and all the first wave, second wave, third, you know, they're just like amazing women. We're able to say things that I can't say, that Filipino women don't say. The millennials are starting to say it. The Gen Z for sure are saying it. But in my generation, Gen X and boomers, they weren't saying it. And so they were articulating embodiment and violence and beauty. And, you know, they were articulating things in theology that I hadn't ever thought of or was given permission to as a Filipino American. And so I felt like womanist theology gave me permission to explore who I am and to be proud of who I am in a very different way. And so that's part of what really resonates. And, you know, I love the idea, you know, when people say like, listen to Black women, it's like, no, seriously, listen to Black women. Like they know stuff. And I don't know why you even have to say, listen to Black women. That should just be a standard way of living. Like, you know, and it's true. And from there, you know, Black women like Shaniqua have opened the table in a different way and invited others in a very different way. My favorite introduction of a book, and who does this, but Wilda Gaffney in her Womanist Midrash has the best introduction of all time. And it's her saying, you know what? I'm going to invite you to my Sunday dinner. You need to try everything. You don't need to like everything, but you need to try what I'm serving you. And it is the most beautiful and open and also self-caring way of sharing who she is that I've read in a book like that. And so this is the beauty of what Black women have to offer. We have to listen to them.
That's so good. That is so good. You actually wrote something. Didn't you write something along the lines of a smorgasbord?
I call it potluck theology. And I think that's probably why, you know, Dr. Gaffney's introduction resonated so much, right? And not to be stereotypical, but right, for women, it's a lot of us, and actually even men, it's our love language.
Yes.
It's to share, right?
It's my love language.
It's from our being. Yeah. Okay. It's not just women, but there is a like, the intimacy and the interplay of food and giving and hospitality and sharing it with others and inviting people to the table and who gets invited to the table. And so, you know, you've got your Norman Rockwell Thanksgiving picture where there's six seats and a head and a turkey and everyone's got their place. But there's only so many places at this tall white man's table. You go to my potlucks in my family, there's no seats. There's too many. There's 60 of us. No one's sitting at the table. And you know what? If you put chairs around the table, you can't get to the food because there's so much food. We need all the space available. You can't put your plate. Now you're taking up too much space. Go sit somewhere else, right? There's no table. And, you know, I brought this analogy and one of my Samoan friends said, shoot, we don't even use a table. We just sit on the floor. And I was like, yes, like that's how you should do potluck, right? Like we have this concept of leadership, you know, whatever, of this hierarchical, limited table that people can eat on with one main dish. Again, in my family potlucks, there's not one main dish. We have turkey, ham, prime rib, you know, pinak bit. You don't even know the side dishes from the main dishes because they're all the same size, you know. So it's just changing up the way that we see the table.
Yeah. There's something when I've heard you tell this story before, and I love for you to elaborate on this part about the difference between some people's potlucks and Filipinos' potluck, or I know in our African-Americans' potluck of bringing your best mm-hmm. dish versus going to the store. Could you elaborate and talk about that? You connect it with leadership, and I think that's what the brilliance of it is.
Yeah. So, you know, the first non-Filipino potluck I've been to was at school. And I saw like a sleeve of Oreos, like a Costco chicken. I was like, what the heck is this? And I didn't understand. And what I realized was, oh, these potlucks, you bring the easiest thing to the table. It's your buy-in. It's the least amount that I can bring to the table, the easiest, the fastest, just so I can participate. In my family's potlucks, it's no, you bring your best dish. And you better make those mashed potatoes like nobody's business, because we will let you know if those mashed potatoes are not good. And also, by the way, can you make a vegan one and a non-dairy one while you're at it? I have done that. But that's love, right? Is to make sure that like everyone can join. But you bring your best dish so that everyone gets to feast out of the abundance. Everyone gets to feast out of each other's best. And so instead of just participating at minimum.
Wow.
Now we're participating in our fullness of one another, and we're giving abundantly and we're receiving abundantly. And so there's a different way of interacting in it, but it's a, you have to come wanting to honor the other people first. And that's a very different way of doing leadership. It's, I grew up with the idea of like servant leadership, and it's like, well, kind of, but it's even more than just trying to be this actually kind of falsely humble servant.
Right.
It's really like, I cannot stand the idea of giving you anything less than my best.
Right.
I have to give you the best thing that I can give you.
And I was also going to say that it's not just like if there's going to be eight people, you make exactly 7.5 servings. It's make three times the amount that of people that are going to be there just in case, right?
And so you have take homes.
Your play cousins are coming over too, you know?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. Again, I mean, hats off to my Samoan friends. I've never seen this, like at least in Filipino. They already know, and they have those takeout boxes from Costco. They're like, we're already going to send this home to auntie and to uncle over there because they didn't make it. Like that thought of like sending it home to the people who couldn't make it and the people who want to take plates home. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, as a student for most of my life, I was taking those plates home. I needed it. You know, it's beautiful.
It's beautiful. It's real. And it's funny because when we did the Asian American Civil Rights Tour, that was my posture with it was, and I even told the group, it's like, I hope we learn how do we lead in a way that we're actually leading from the rear. We're not leading up front, because the way that we're always taught is, typically it has to be a man that's leading, but you lead, you're the main voice. It's like, no, how do we flip that on its head? How do I lead in a way where I'm creating a space that I actually learn from? So my giving is learning. It's not just giving and giving a very incomplete history or an incomplete story. So yeah, that's...
Can I challenge that a little bit?
Sure.
So to say leading from the rear still assumes that there's a line. Mm-hmm. Why do we even need the line?
Oh, right? I like that.
Can we lead in a way where we're processing together and being with each other without having to have this linear, because that's where scarcity starts, is when there's only certain spaces.
No, I received that 1,000%. That's amazing. I love it.
That's good.
I offer that to you.
I received it. That's good. That's a mic drop. That's a total mic drop. Let's shift gears just slightly, because we're starting to wind down. We ask all of our guests, how do you ground yourself in the midst of the challenges of doing the type of work that you're doing? Maybe like, what are some of the rhythms or the practices that you do to center and ground yourself?
Whew, that's a great question. One is I try to stay close to my extended family as much as I can. Most of them are in Seattle now, and so or Washington. And but I need to remember where I came from and whose I belong to at the end of the day. And so I try to. That's why a lot of my work centers around them, because everything begins with them for me. Also, I have a very small group of friends who have permission to kick my butt. and they know it, and they take that permission on its face and say, great. And so, you know, even when I'm talking about potluck theology, right, I'm being challenged. And you know, I have a friend who's like, you talk about abundance, like you embody it. He's like, all I see is scarcity. And I'm like, oh, that's painful to hear. But that's also what grounds you into like, okay, how do I keep pushing myself so that I'm not just this talking head? How do I keep living this out in a genuine way? Mm-hmm. So, you know, relationships is part of my spiritual practices, actually. And then aside from that, you know, it's there is a charismatic side to me. That's on my face and trying to hear for the voice of God as much as humanly possible. And, you know, DMing friends like, hey, you got some time for some prayer? Like, let's make one of those times happen. And that deep crying out, listening, like, the Holy Spirit is with us prayer. Like,
yes.
I don't have time for the, you know, kind of rub-a-dub-dub things for the girl. You know, like, I need to go deep, you know? So that's another practice.
No, that's good. You mentioned the theology and you said it kind of quickly. Can you say it again when you're talking about this abundance?
Oh, potluck.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Potluck. I'm sorry. Okay.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's what I've been calling it. I've been kicking around the idea for like 20 years now. But I'm starting to realize that the idea of potluck theology is about leadership. It's about communal ecumenicism. It's about my own embodiment. And so it's I don't know. Theology is kind of the best word I landed on, but
yeah, that's a good one, because who doesn't like food?
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
That's good. Practices is another way I describe it. Practices of potluck. You know, how do we practice potluck in a very giving, abundant way?
Yeah. Is there a question that you think that our listeners should be asking themselves?
Can we narrow down the question a little bit more?
Sure. So as they are walking along in this journey towards understanding racism and injustice and moving towards being part of the solution, is there something that they should be thinking on that will help them to maybe get to a better understanding, getting a little further down along in the journey?
You know, I don't know necessarily about all the other listeners, but my life's work right now, personal work, is breaking up with a tall white man, and it's decolonizing and dismantling the patriarchies the systems that I've grown up in and still live in, and, you know, will continue to live in. But I have to keep asking that question, you know, like, what do I need to keep breaking up with? Because, it's been abusive to me. It's been abusive to others. We can't keep having this kind of relationship.
Ooh, that's good. That's really good. So as we wrap up, we also ask all of our guests book recommendations, and you've listed so many. And we'll go back and listen through this and kind of capture them. Are there a few books that you would put highest on your list that people should be reading, or other resources? It doesn't have to necessarily be a book.
You know, I would say Women of Color All Day Long, just Women of Color All Day Long. I think in the work of breaking up with a tall white man, Women of Color are sort of the antithesis in ways of seeing the world and ways of seeing each other. And so, you know, good or bad writing, it almost doesn't matter, because it's not the same writing that we've been reading for decades, at least. Right. Mm-hmm. So we just need to keep hearing their voices.
Yes, for sure. That's really good. And like I said, we'll go back through and gather all of the references the wonderful references that you made, for sure. What's the best way for people to connect with you?
Yes. My website is joycedelrosario.com, joycedelrosario. .com. And then my Twitter is @PrayingPilipino.
Oh, I love it.
So the story is, it was paleo Filipino. I went off paleo and I was like, well, I still pray, so we can change it to that.
I love it. I had my season of paleo as well. I had my season of paleo.
It was good to me. I need to go to me, back
there. Right? That's something I should not have broken up with.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
Well, Dr. Joyce, it has been an absolute pleasure just being able to chat with you and to just gain so much wisdom from everything that you've had to say. Do you have any last thoughts or comments for our listeners before we sign off?
Yeah. In particular, we need to pay attention to the increased violence in our Asian American communities. One, just focus on Asian Americans because we aren't seen. But two, as it relates to Black Lives Matter. And then three, as it relates to all of the systems that we're under and are starting to scratch the surface around in a new way. Not starting altogether, but just kind of a new way. But we need to keep doing the work, and we can't stop doing the work.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, Joyce, thank you for helping me to feel a little bit of justice today. Thank you.
Ooh, exhale. Right, exhale.
For sure. Exhale. Well, everyone, thank you so much for joining the Disruptive Peacemakers podcast. We know that you've enjoyed this particular episode. It's been very relevant to the moment that we are in. We look forward to you joining us again on our next episode. Take care, everyone.
Bye.
Disruptive Peacemakers.